And today's last word in business is McCurry. We've been closely following this story. McCurry is the name of a restaurant in Malaysia, and McDonald's is not loving it. For the last 8 years, McDonald's has been trying to force the small family restaurant to drop the Mick from its name. The legal battle went all the way to the highest court, and yesterday the fast food giant lost. The court's reasoning was that the smaller restaurant's use of the prefix Mick in McCurry did not cause consumer confusion because the two restaurants offer such different foods. McDonald's 185 outlets in Malaysia offer mostly the usual beef burgers. McCurry serves chicken curry and other typical Indian dishes like tandoori naan, which they don't call tandoori McNaan. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Monte.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Hubble Space Telescope has been orbiting Earth for 19 years, and it's working better than ever. That's what NASA officials said today. They were releasing the first images taken by Hubble after astronauts refurbished it. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has the story.
The Hubble Space Telescope has been upgraded 5 times in space. The most recent mission almost didn't happen. It was canceled after the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. NASA officials felt going to Hubble again might be too risky. But astronomers fought the decision, hoping to keep Hubble alive. And in the end, the mission went forward in May. Astronauts did 5 tricky spacewalks. They installed a new camera, added a fancy new spectrograph, plus fixed 2 other instruments. Ed Weiler heads up NASA's Science Mission Directorate. He says after the mission was over, he kept hearing one question.
When are we going to see the pictures? We know we've had successful spacewalks, but when will we see the pictures?
Today, at a press conference at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., a music video featuring colorful new pictures flashed on a screen. Faraway galaxies, a nebula shaped like a butterfly, and a densely packed star cluster. After a summer testing and calibrating the telescope, scientists say Hubble is now more powerful than ever before. Heidi Hamel works at the Space Science Institute in Boulder, Colorado.
We in the community are already starting to get our data, and we're giddy with the quality of the data that we have with this new telescope.
David LaCrone is senior project scientist for Hubble at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He says with the new and improved Hubble, the backgrounds of images are full of interesting detail.
You can already see remarkable differences between what we're seeing now and what we saw with the prior instrumentation, just in this ability to see, look what's in the background. My goodness, I didn't realize that was there.
He says plans for future observations include studying objects like Pluto at the edge of our solar system and analyzing the atmospheres of planets around other stars. The astronauts who did all these fixes last spring say they were amazed by the new pictures. Mike Massimino says when they closed up Hubble for the last time and came home, they thought the mission had gone well.
And so it's really great to see the evidence that it actually does work, and those images just look great. And I am so grateful that it's working and that I didn't break anything.
NASA has no plans to repair Hubble again. The hope is that it will continue working until at least 2014. That's when the agency plans to launch the James Webb Space Telescope, a new large space observatory. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
And you can see that nebula shaped like a butterfly and more Hubble images at NPR.org.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Melissa Block. On the program this week, we've been remembering this time last year, a time a lot of you might rather forget. The Treasury Department took over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The legendary investment bank Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And the world's largest insurance company, AIG, was threatening to bring down the entire banking system.
And all these events took place in the middle of the presidential campaign. As part of our series on the financial crisis 1 year later, NPR's Don Gagne reports on how it changed the course of that campaign.
A year ago this time, the big political conventions had just ended. Election day was less than 2 months away, but suddenly there was just one story and just one issue.
You know what? Right now, breaking news here, stocks all around the world are tanking because of the crisis on Wall Street.
President Bush, overshadowed for months by the campaign, found himself with another major crisis to deal with.
The American people are concerned about the situation in our financial markets and our economy, and I share their concerns.
So did the two major party nominees, Democrat Barack Obama and Republican John McCain, each trying to demonstrate his readiness to handle the crisis if elected. But McCain's strength was national security, and his resume as a war hero. The economy had been his weak spot going back to the primaries. His first reaction in September was an effort to reassure the public.
Our economy, I think, still, the fundamentals of our economy are strong, but these are very, very difficult times.
Candidate Obama pounced, seeing his chance to tie McCain to the economic policies of President Bush.
This is what happens when you see 7 years of incomes falling for the average worker while Wall Street is booming and declare, as Senator McCain did earlier this year, that we've made great economic progress under George Bush. This is how you can reach the conclusion as late as yesterday that the fundamentals of the economy are strong.
McCain's problems were compounded by a decision to suspend his campaign until Congress dealt with emergency legislation to bolster the economy. He even said he would cancel his appearance at a presidential debate, a call he later reversed. Earlier in September, McCain had taken a modest lead in polls. But once the economy became the issue, Mr. Obama pulled ahead and began to pull away. Looking back, this was the decisive moment in the fall campaign. But David Axelrod, a senior advisor to the president and a top Obama campaign strategist, says the outcome wasn't so clear at the time.
I think it became a great test of leadership at that moment, and I think it redounded to his benefit. But we had no way of predicting that. At the time, all we knew is that a very serious crisis was in the offing, and he wanted to deal with it in as responsible a way as possible.
That very serious crisis has continued to dominate the agenda under the new president. Within weeks of his inauguration, he signed into law a $787 billion economic stimulus package.
I don't want to pretend that today marks the end of our economic problems, nor does it constitute all of what we're going to have to do to turn our economy around. But today does mark the beginning of the end.
The stimulus passed without a single Republican vote in the House, and the opposition has continued to accuse the White House of trying to spend its way out of recession, running up huge deficits. Here's Congressman Eric Cantor, the Republican whip, on Fox News this summer.
I do think it is fair to say that the stimulus is a flop. The goal that was set when we passed it was unemployment wouldn't rise past 8.5%, and what we see now is businesses just aren't hiring.
But the White House counters that the benefits of the stimulus have only begun to be felt, and that without it, the recession might have been far worse. At a union picnic in Cincinnati yesterday, the president looked for good news, even amid reports of 216,000 jobs lost in August.
But for the second straight month, we lost fewer jobs than the month before, and it was the fewest jobs that we had lost in a year. So, make no mistake, we're moving in the right direction. We're on the road to recovery, Ohio. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
But the road to recovery can be long and hard and politically painful, especially for a president and a party that took over promising an end to the economic crisis. Don Gagne, NPR News, Washington.
And NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson, has been listening in with us. Mara, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
He says that the president is still aiming for big, meaningful reform, but as Renee pointed out, some conservative Democrats aren't sure they want to go along. Is the president, based on your reporting, lowering his sights a little bit here?
I don't think he's lowering his sights. I think his goal is still the same as it's been all along, which is to somehow find a consensus so that some kind of health care reform can pass. He's got a big, big challenge tonight. Not only does he have to clear up the confusion about health care, as Robert Gibbs says, he has to give people a pretty clear idea about what they're going to get, what's going to happen to their own insurance if something passes. But he also really has to try to thread the needle and find a consensus inside his own party. Almost every Republican has taken themselves out of this debate. they're going to vote no. But inside the president's own party, there's a big, deep division, particularly about the public option. And there are liberal Democrats who say they won't vote for the bill if it doesn't have a public option. And there are conservative Democrats who say they won't vote for a bill if it has a robust Medicare-style public option. So tonight, he really has to thread the needle. And the White House has been very coy about exactly how he's going to do that.
When the president's press secretary doesn't make a veto threat there, he says, you know, we just want to get something that provides choice and competition. Is he essentially telling Democrats still, please, please agree amongst yourselves on something you can all vote for?
Sure. I think one of the things that the White House has been trying to do is to try to figure out where the center of this debate is inside their own party. That is exactly what you said. What kind of bill can get passed by both houses in the end? Now, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has said over and over again that no bill can pass the House of Representatives without a public option. But it's pretty clear to the White House at this point that a bill with a robust-style public option cannot get 60 votes in the Senate. What you have seen over the past couple of days is that I think that the center of the debate is moving away from that robust Medicare-style public option. You've got people as disparate as a conservative Democrat from Nebraska, Ben Nelson, and a liberal Democrat from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, saying nice things about a trigger, that is a fallback public option. And you even have the number two Democrat in the House, Steny Hoyer, saying, although he is for a public option, he could vote for a bill without one.
Okay. Mara, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson, one of our correspondents who will be listening tonight as President Obama addresses Congress and the nation on health care. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
This next story is the sort that inspires letter writing. First off, a warning. It contains a lot of offensive language. In fact, it's about offensive language. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports on a word that was once a garden variety insult and now might be the next candidate for bleeping.
The word is retard, and it's one E. Duff Robel used to use occasionally. Then his daughter was born with Down syndrome. She was a baby when he had her in a car seat, and another car cut him off. Like anyone else, Robel started yelling.
And I actually said that word, and then I stopped my car and got teary, and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just said that.
Robel started a passionate anti-retard campaign. To him, it's hate speech.
I'd like to get it to where it's bleeped off the television. I've written to every commissioner on the FCC, I've written to the president, I've written to Oprah 5 times.
And Robel has made a few inroads, alongside the activists who made retard unacceptable in medical and social service circles. There, the term intellectual disabilities is preferred. They organize against movies like last summer's hit film Tropic Thunder. In one memorable exchange, two movie stars discuss the kind of roles that can win you Oscars.
Everybody knows you never go full retard.
What do you mean?
Check it out. Dustin Hoffman, Ray Man, look retarded, act retarded, not retarded. Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump. Slow, yes, braces on his legs, but that ain't retarded. You went full retard, man.
The protest against Tropic Thunder did not have much effect on the movie. But not long ago, film critic Eric Snyder was reviewing a DVD for a stinker of a film called Miss March.
Hey, gang, we're here today to talk to you about
Miss March is an insult comedy. That's all it is. It came out in theaters last spring, but Snyder realized it was changed for DVD.
I noticed a scene where it's a couple of abstinence promoters are telling horror stories to middle school students.
He got syphilis.
Then she got pregnant, and because she smoked cigarettes, the baby came out a crackhead.
It was obvious that the actress's lips did not say crackhead.
They said retard.
It added up to about 5 instances in the movie where obviously they had redubbed it for the DVD.
And it's not just movies rethinking retard as an easy laugh. A few months ago, popular sex advice columnist Dan Savage renounced his use of the word.
You know, I just sat down to write the column, and I'd used the word retard in the column recently, and I was sorting through the mail, and there was a handful of letters taking me to task, and I thought, all right, I won't use it anymore. I'll use a new word. I hope you like this one better.
The new word was leotard, as in, you are totally leotarded.
It was me just being a jerk, frankly. you know, I've heard people now use the R word in reference to retard, and it just seems so pansy-assed, if I may use that phrase.
Savage is gay, and he knows how it feels to be the target of insults and slurs. What's funny is that gay and retard occupy the same linguistic position when it comes to schoolyard trash talk.
To mean bad, you know, that movie was totally gay.
Jesse Scheidlauer is an editor for the Oxford English Dictionary. He traced the use of retard as an insult to a late 1950s book that refers to Playboy magazine.
And a character says, well, that Hefner jazz is for retarded jockstraps.
Retarded is an all-purpose put-down, says Scheidlauer. Same goes for gay. They don't mean something is literally intellectually disabled or literally homosexual. And that differentiates those words from racist slurs. Atlantic Monthly columnist Ta-Nehisi Coates writes on issues like race and language.
And I actually love the word nigger. I actually like it a lot. I don't like it used towards me in certain contexts. But I think nigger's a great word. I think it's a fine word.
Coates says in order for language to become socially unacceptable, it needs to be linked with the kind of bigoted behavior no one wants to be associated with.
As a young man, I use the word chink all the time. Fag, another word I used. There's nothing for me to deploy that word. We referred to the corner store as the chink store and thought nothing of it, never considered it.
And, Coates says, in order for retard to be considered inappropriate, there needs to be a fundamental shift in empathy for people with intellectual disabilities.
What happens is, if you're lucky, you come to understand that those words describe actual human beings.
Until then, retard may continue as a commonplace zinger, but it seems people are beginning to think twice about it. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
And how do you feel about the R word? Are there other insults you're thinking twice about? We're talking about it on our website. You can join Netta Ulibi at npr.org.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.